Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
Ukraine launches its counteroffensive, losing some tanks but gaining ground.
This offensive has been a long time in the preparation, and the Russians know it's coming. They too have been preparing their defensive lines. So the only element of surprise here is where exactly along that front line Ukraine will try to make the big breakthrough.
UBS completes its takeover of Credit Suisse, and former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has died at age 86. It's Monday, June 12th. I'm Keith Collins for The Wall Street Journal, filling in for Luke Vargas. And here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Ukraine's much-anticipated counteroffensive has begun. So far, Ukrainian forces have retaken several villages in the southeastern Zaporizhia and eastern Donetsk regions, but have also lost several tanks to Russian minefields. Our reporter Marcus Walker is on his way to the front line, and I spoke to him earlier about what we know so far.
The Ukrainians so far are attacking the very first Russian defensive positions. That's not the main defensive line. The Russians have deeper, very formidable fortifications further south and further east of their most forward positions. At the moment, it appears that the Ukrainians are trying to attack the first Russian defenses at several different points along the 600-kilometer front line, searching for weak spots. And so far, it looks like they're attacking with relatively small formations. We're not seeing the big armored thrusts yet that military analysts expect will be deployed once the Ukrainians have decided where they want to try and make their big breakthrough.
Marcus, we've heard that Ukraine has gained some ground, but also lost tanks. What's the latest on the ground?
In this southern and southeastern sector of the front, in the Zaporizhia and Donetsk regions, the Ukrainians have made several assaults over recent days, and the soldiers we've spoken to are moderately satisfied. The fighting is hard, the gaining of villages and of ground is hard work, hard fighting. There are casualties, vehicles have been lost, some of the German-made Leopard 2 tanks have been lost, some of the US-made Bradley fighting vehicles have been lost. The Ukrainians are vulnerable from the air. The Russians are able to use their air power against these ground formations that are moving. Although it appears that in many cases, the Ukrainians have been able to retrieve and recover damaged vehicles from the battlefield too.
Okay, and what does that tell us about the counteroffensive? Has it gotten off to a good start?
These are very early days of the Ukrainian offensive. It will probably go on all summer. These are the first probes. Ukraine is not yet showing its hand. We don't yet know. Nobody knows where they will make their main efforts to break through the Russian lines. This offensive has been a long time in the preparation, and the Russians know it's coming. They too have been preparing their defensive lines for a long time. So the only element of surprise here is where exactly along that front line Ukraine will try to make the big breakthrough.
And what has Kyiv said about the counteroffensive so far?
The Ukrainian government is saying very little so far about the offensive beyond confirming eventually the names of the villages that they've taken. Troops are also trying to maintain a very tight level of information security so that the Russians know as little as possible about what's going on. But talking to soldiers who are involved, we can certainly get a sense of how these assaults are unfolding at the tactical level and of the mood among the Ukrainian troops, which is determined with solid morale, but they know it's going to be a long and tough fight.
And how is Moscow responding?
On the Russian side, the Russian government is claiming that the Ukrainians are failing in all their attempts, but some of the military bloggers who are affiliated with the Russian military are sometimes posting quite accurate information and admitting that the Ukrainians are making some gains on the ground.
And so, Marcus, what should we expect to see in the coming months from this counteroffensive? What is the end goal here?
We're still in the very early stages of this Ukrainian offensive. They have not yet encountered the main Russian line of fortifications, which many people refer to as a Russian version of the Maginot Line from World War II. These are still preparatory attacks clearing the way for Ukrainian forces to make their big assaults on those Russian fortifications. It is strategically very important to the outcome of the whole war, because if the Ukrainians can break through these Russian lines and push down to the sea, break the land barrier that connects Russia proper with occupied Crimea, that could really change the whole outlook of this war. Whereas if the Ukrainians are unable to make significant headway, then it's possible that international pressure will grow for a freeze in the fighting and for negotiations with Russia, which Ukraine fears might spell the end of their hopes of ever getting back the regions of their country that Russia has occupied. Among Ukrainian soldiers fighting down here in the south of their country, there is widespread knowledge that this is going to be long and arduous, but there is also great determination to make this a success. As one of the soldiers who've been fighting near Velika Novosilka told us, we have no other option. This is our home.
And that was Journal reporter Marcus Walker speaking to us from the Ukrainian front line this morning. Coming up, a look at Silvio Berlusconi's legacy, and more details emerge on Donald Trump's legal strategy ahead of tomorrow's arraignment. All that and more after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
In other news this morning, former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who dominated the nation's politics for nearly two decades amid a string of scandals, has died, aged 86. Berlusconi's death was confirmed by an official from his political party today. The media tycoon was a divisive figure at home, and often a target of ridicule abroad, for his racy jokes, sex scandals, and overlapping political and business interests. Berlusconi was Italy's longest-serving post-war prime minister. Donald Trump's legal team is mounting a two-pronged courtroom defense against last week's 37-count indictment related to the handling of classified documents. The defense team is likely to focus on Trump's past presidential powers to declassify documents and the looming 2024 election, for which he is the early Republican frontrunner. Trump has been charged with knowingly retaining classified documents he kept after leaving the White House and later obstructing the government's efforts to retrieve them. The former president and his alleged co-conspirator, his valet, Walt Nauda, are scheduled to be arraigned Tuesday in Miami for a court battle that is expected to play out during much, if not all, of next year's presidential campaign. Trump has declared his innocence, saying, "This vicious persecution is a travesty of justice," in a speech in Georgia on Saturday. A major legal challenge to Google's platforms in Hong Kong has been postponed from today to July 21st. Hong Kong authorities are looking to block the online dissemination of a pro-democracy anthem titled Glory to Hong Kong. The song can be found in several videos on YouTube. The local government says the song includes a slogan that amounts to advocating secession. Journal Tech reporter Newly Purnell is in Hong Kong. He explains that this case marks the first major legal challenge to American tech companies over politically sensitive content in the city.
There's certainly a feeling among people I've talked to that we're starting to see this shift now, that the companies are preemptively deciding what we can't offer our services here if they're going to violate the law. And so I think that the distinction here is that there would be this shock if in this global financial center where people are used to being able to access the global internet, if you see this pullback, if you see new services not being offered here, it marks this big departure where people value the free flow of information, and companies often will cite as a reason that they're based here in Hong Kong that people, they want their employees to be able to access the internet and data flows. That seems to be perhaps starting to change, and I think that that's alarming to some people.
UBS has finalized its takeover of Credit Suisse, ending a months-long saga that saw the collapse of one of Switzerland's biggest financial institutions. The bank described the deal as, quote, the beginning of a new historic chapter. However, WSJ Heard on the Street columnist John Sindreu says the deal isn't that popular with investors.
So investors have not liked this deal. Actually, shares in UBS had done really well for the past 2 years. Now, suddenly, they find that UBS is buying a bank in a deal that still has so many open questions. These investors were happy getting their dividends and looking at how the bank's profitability was improving. Suddenly, they need to deal with all of this. So UBS's stock is actually underperforming broader European banks this year. So investors don't like this. We are in an environment where it is very hard for the market to get excited about anything to do with banks because the global economy is slowing. So it's hard for them to get on board with this story, even though UBS is getting Credit Suisse at a massive discount. But over the long term, it really seems hard to argue that UBS did not get a massive deal.
UBS said Friday that it has signed a loss protection agreement with the Swiss government covering up to 9 billion francs, roughly $10 billion, of losses from the takeover of Credit Suisse. The legendary investor, philanthropist, and right-wing target George Soros is handing control of his $25 billion empire to his son, Alexander Soros. The 37-year-old, who goes by Alex, told the Journal in his first interview as successor that the family's $25 billion philanthropic enterprise will boost its support for voting and abortion rights, as well as gender equality, in line with his father's liberal aims. A first-of-its-kind climate trial is set to kick off today in the state of Montana to determine whether the state's constitution obligates public officials to do more to address global warming. The plaintiffs are a dozen young residents between the ages of 2 and 18 who argue that the state's constitution since 1972 has explicitly guaranteed the right to a clean and healthful environment. This case is among a wave of similar suits across the country, arguing that future generations will bear the consequences of a warming planet. The state has opposed the suit on procedural grounds, arguing in court documents that the constitutional challenge is overly broad. And speaking of the environment, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is looking at how companies market products with environmental claims. The agency's new green guides aim to help businesses avoid accusations of greenwashing. WSJ Sustainable Business reporter Dieter Holger says regulators are worried shoppers don't understand the ballooning number of environmental terms that brands are now using.
Sales of goods that are advertising sustainability are going up. They have been at more than a quarter of $1 trillion a year. The FTC is asking if it should provide more guidance on 19 different green terms that are becoming a lot more commonplace in shopping aisles. Things like carbon neutral and net zero, for instance. Generally, we see that industry groups and companies are against regulations, which is unsurprising. But we actually have seen SC Johnson, a consumer goods company, is actually encouraging these regulations to make the guardrails clearer for the industry and create a level playing field.
And finally, summer is upon us, and undoubtedly for many, a plane ride to a beach far away. But what if your typical jet didn't have the usual rows of seats and motors hanging off the wings? Aircraft manufacturers like Boeing and Airbus are working on new designs that are more environmentally friendly. Airbus Vice President Glenn Llewellyn told our Future of Everything podcast that hydrogen fuel will mean some planes could look like giant boomerangs.
In today's aircraft, it's mostly the case that we store the fuel in the wings. Fuel would no longer be stored there, and so you can have potentially thinner wings, more optimized wings from a pure aerodynamic perspective.
And according to Airbus, those hydrogen-powered jets could take flight as soon as 2035. You can hear more about how Boeing, Airbus, and other companies are trying to make air travel more environmentally friendly on the WSJ podcast, The Future of Everything. And that's What's News for Monday morning. We will be back tonight with a new show. I'm Keith Collins with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
Technology can make the world better. At UST, we're building a future where people everywhere are empowered to live better lives.
It's transformation you can feel.
And you don't have to do it alone.
We believe in the power of technology to transform businesses and build a better world.